At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, another installment of, hey, everybody, all that economic support is going away soon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 23rd day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So you know that thing where you know something bad is coming and your senses just kind of start going in slow motion, but you can't really do anything about it? Yeah, that, except the economy. We have been spending this week looking at the different ways that $600 a week in extra unemployment benefits going away next week is going to play out. Today's slice is people in the gig economy who, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, are likely to feel the pain most acutely.
Jennifer Jesse has a one-woman SAT and ACT tutoring business in Woodbridge, Virginia. Heading into the spring, she had lots of work lined up. Then COVID-19 hit in mid-March and the cancellations started.
So when people would contact me, I would say, I don't think there's going to be an SAT or ACT. And with money being so tight, I would hate for you to waste your money.
Her income's down from about $1,000 a week to less than $200. And as a solo business owner, she wasn't sure where to turn.
It's never really clear what I'm able to apply for. So I started with PPP loans.
She didn't get one, but she did get on unemployment through the federal program that opens up benefits to independent contractors and gig workers. She's received about $2,000. That kind of money is a godsend in this pandemic-shocked economy, says Heidi Shearholtz at the Economic Policy Institute.
It's been absolutely essential.
10 million or more people who wouldn't ordinarily qualify for state benefits are getting them now. The federal government's picking up the tab and adding $600 a week. But that's about to run out.
We're talking about a pretty mammoth drop in the income if the $600 is allowed to expire.
Take the example of Austin, Texas theatrical technical director Zach Crawford. He's been able to make it through so far on unemployment. But when the extra $600 from the feds disappears?
I don't know. Yeah, that'll leave me at $400 a month with Texas's unemployment benefits, which is impossible to live on.
He says he won't have enough to cover basic expenses or keep up his studio and equipment till theaters open again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Senate Republicans and the White House say they've got an agreement in principle amongst themselves on the latest economic support package. Democrats in the House have their package that passed in May, negotiations obviously to come. Part of whatever winds up finally passing, though, is going to have more support for small businesses, a lot of which, even with the Paycheck Protection Program, missed out in the last bill, especially minority-owned small businesses, which have chronically had big problems getting access to capital. As it happens, there was a hearing about exactly that in the Senate today, and Marketplace's Kimberly Adams was listening in.
Black business owners had a particularly rough time getting access to PPP funds at first, says Ronald Busby. He's president of U.S. Black Chambers, a body that represents thousands of business owners. He told the Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship that 70% of his members who applied for PPP loans were denied, and almost everyone who was approved received less than they asked for. The problem, he says, didn't begin with the pandemic.
Access to capital is the number one, number two, number three concern for Black business owners.
Racial disparities in business lending often push small business owners to non-traditional lenders, which focus on underrepresented groups. Marla Bolanek is CEO of the Latino Economic Development Center, and she also testified in the Senate today.
We had many, many clients come to us that had a false start attempt with their bank and never got to the end of the process because they just simply weren't a high enough priority.
Of course, banks aren't the only source of capital to help start a business or keep it afloat in a crisis. Robert Fairley is an economics professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
You know, a lot of owners borrow against their home equity through home equity lines or use other, you know, family members or their community to help them.
But, says Fairley, even that approach tends to reveal economic disparities, highlighting the racial wealth gap in this country and the fact that minority communities are already suffering the worst health and economic effects of the pandemic. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A correction before we go on from the program yesterday, talking about those extra unemployment benefits expiring. Truckee Tahoe Radio 101.5 on your FM dial did not lay off all of its employees. They were, in fact, working from home, and we regret the error. There might have been some regrets on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so let's get big picture here for a minute, if we might. America and its place in this global economy. When both of those things, three things, actually, America, its economy, and the global economy are under no small amount of strain. We are more than half of global stock market capitalization, about 15-ish percent of global gross domestic product. We're a key market for much of the global supply chain. So what happens to everybody else when we struggle as we are? Susan M. Collins is the provost at the University of Michigan. She's also an international economist. She's a professor at the Ford School of Public Policy there. Professor Collins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you.
Without overstating the case for the American economy, how bad is it for the global economy that this virus is doing damage to the United States and its economy?
Well, I would say that it is quite problematic. At the same time, it's difficult to put any precise numbers around that. There is the old adage that when the U.S. sneezes, the global economy has a cold. And I would add that some countries get pneumonia. So the impact is certainly widely differentiated for a variety of different reasons.
So if I'm Angela Merkel in Germany or Prime Minister Abe in Japan or in a developing economy, how worried ought I be about what's going on here?
Well, I think you should be quite worried. At the same time, you should be worried for many reasons. But it's also true that the U.S. economy is not as large a share of the global economy as it was some decades ago, and it's not the only engine of global growth. At the same time, this pandemic, of course, has impacted all countries all over the world, and so all of them are reeling, which means it's not obvious that there is another engine of growth that's going to come in and take over.
Are you looking to China as perhaps that engine? They seem to be, you know, they got in the recession faster and they seem to be out faster while we are still struggling.
Well, you know, if you think back to a year or two or so ago, U.S. economy was slowing and China and other emerging markets, in particular in Asia, were where we were looking to for engines of growth. You know, at the same time, the forecast for China has fallen dramatically. It's still positive. The IMF has it at 1% for the year ahead. But that's dramatically down from where they had it some months ago.
Let me take you sideways for a second with the observation that you're a trained economist, not a professor of political risk analysis, but it does seem germane. What do you make of the heightened tensions in the U.S.-Chinese relationship? Certainly trade started it, but now we have the consulate in Houston and lots of barbed words on both sides.
Well, I think it's all part of the mix. They all reinforce each other. And to see those tensions escalate as we're in the midst of these other challenges is reinforcing. So, you know, we have the trade channels. We have the channels through financial markets and then also through commodity markets. And then in addition, the geopolitical tensions, it's all reinforcing because investor sentiments are a major part of what the kind of forecast uncertainties are connected to.
Right. So that goes to mood. And last question, and then I'll let you go. Investor sentiment, you mentioned the consumer mood is extremely uncertain and anxious. As you look globally, everybody pretty much shares that. Is there a neat and tidy way out of this thing, or do we just have to ride it out and wait for this virus to make up its mind?
I don't think there are any silver bullets here. And this is a very different recession than ones that we're used to. I think the kinds of interventions that the Fed has been doing are helpful, and the rest of the world also looks to U.S. monetary policy. I think the promising signs in terms of an additional fiscal package are helpful as well. But, you know, there are lots of twists and turns that are going to happen before this one gets resolved. And that takes me back to the various uncertainties and the fact that there are so many channels that are interwoven here.
Susan M. Collins is the provost at the University of Michigan, also a professor of economics at the Ford School of Public Policy there. Professor Collins, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
In antitrust news today, there are reports out there that the Justice Department is not going to block the proposed merger between internet companies Outbrain and Taboola. What's that you say? Never heard of them? Yeah, fair enough, but chances are you feel them every day. They're the ones responsible for those chunks of sponsored content at the bottom of a lot of websites, those things mixed in with straight news articles. Clickbait might ring a bell here. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look at what the DOJ's decision to look the other way might mean for users.
You are not going to believe what I'm going to tell you in a few seconds. Okay, that's not really our way of doing things, but Joshua Braun at the University of Massachusetts Amherst says that space called sponsored content makes a good chunk of change for everybody involved.
The publication where the ad is appearing makes some money by selling that ad space. The company that wants their link visited, that site also displays ads.
Taboola and Outbrain deal in different kinds of sponsored content. One version is designed to polish a brand. The other is just about clicks, with articles like, read this before you buy that hot air fryer.
They just want any visitors, any traffic that they can bring back to their site.
Kunal Gupta is CEO of the ad tech company Polar, which provides services to Outbrain. He says this merger likely won't change much, for users anyway. This deal is about competing against the giants that dominate the internet ad space.
The scale is still small relative to what's actually happening on the internet in the face of Google and Facebook.
And that's likely one reason the Justice Department isn't blocking the merger. Brian Weiser at the media services company Group M says while users aren't likely to notice much, websites that display the ads could end up earning less.
If you're a publisher, you are probably better off considering two different offers rather than one.
The merger still faces a regulatory hurdle in Europe. Oh, and before you go, you gotta hear about a miracle diet that'll help you lose 10 pounds in 1 week. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I sort of felt for a while that I was the potato queen.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the Wawas. Was not expecting that, honestly. Dow Industrials down 353 today, 1.3%, 26,652. The NASDAQ withdrew 244 points, about 2.2%, finished at 10,461. S&P 500 retreated 40 points, 40 points, 1.2%, ended at 32.35. Microsoft, dipped 4.3% despite reporting quarterly results after the bell that bested expectations. Microsoft said some business is slowing and the weakening jobs market is hurting its LinkedIn subsidiary. Other tech companies fell as well. Amazon down 3.6%, Apple off 4.5%, 4.5% is another way to say that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You have heard us talk a lot about the $600 billion Paycheck Protection Program, PPP in the vernacular, meant, of course, to help businesses keep their people on payrolls during the pandemic. Well, there is a new study out this week showing forgivable PPP loans saved as many as 3.2 million jobs through the first week of June. But as we like to say around these parts, numbers often need a little bit of context. Marketplace's Justin Ho has it.
It is way too early to tell whether the jobs that were saved by the Paycheck Protection Program are here to stay, says study author David Otter at MIT.
We don't know if those jobs will persist, if that allows businesses to remain viable that otherwise would have gone under, or if those jobs are going to fade away the minute PPP ends.
But Otter says the findings suggest the government was successful in getting money into the hands of businesses and the employees whose jobs were saved.
So even if you conclude that the PPP had no long-term effect on employment, you would not say the money was just, you know, thrown down a hole. It was distributed to citizens.
Thing is, businesses that received PPP loans employed roughly 50 million before the crisis, says Ernie Tedeschi, an economist at Evercore ISI. The fact that the program only saved 2 or 3 million jobs so far
suggests to me that the PPP went to a lot of businesses who otherwise didn't need the money.
The paper also found that the cost of the job saved amounted to roughly $224,000 per job. Tedeschi says that is high, but it's not surprising given how fast the program rolled out. Overall, he says the study can help policymakers improve future aid programs.
We can see that the next time we want to do small business aid, we should probably target it better than the way we did in the PPP.
MIT's David Otter says we'll continue to know more about how the program has boosted employment as businesses report their payroll numbers in the months ahead. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you know your local Chamber of Commerce, it's probably as a group that sponsors the town Christmas tree lighting or foots the bill for the kids' softball and baseball jerseys, right? And there is, of course, plenty of that. But the real work of the thousands of nonprofit chambers is to promote and lobby on behalf of local businesses. That lobbying takes different forms depending on the state of the economy. And right now, this economy is in a state of who knows? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab caught up with a few chamber CEOs to see what's what with them.
Nogales is a little Arizona border town and a big port of entry for Mexican produce and goods. Only about 20,000 people live there, and plenty of them know Olivia Ainsa Kramer.
My daughter doesn't like to go with me to Walmart because I just always run into people. But it's part of the job, and that's what I do. That's why I do it. I love interacting with people. I love talking to people.
The job is president of the Nogales Santa Cruz County Chamber of Commerce. Ainsa Kramer used to spend her days running around town, dropping in on restaurants and hair salons, and finding ways to bring business owners together. COVID changed all that.
We didn't realize how much we thrive on in-person meetings, on going in for a hug. You know, Latinos, we hug and kiss when we see each other. And now not to be able to do that, it's flipped the script in how we operate.
That's not the only thing that's flipped the script. With the border closed, small businesses can't rely on Mexicans coming into town to shop and go to restaurants. So they have to do more to attract local residents, who Ayensa Kramer says tend to favor big retail chains.
As you know, small town folk, you know, they're so stuck in their day-to-day routine that stepping out a little bit outside of the lines is a little bit uncomfortable and just exploring their town.
1,000 miles north in Casper, Wyoming, businesses were hurting before the pandemic hit and made things worse. This is oil and gas country, and energy prices had already been on the decline. Then people pretty much stopped driving. So far, Wyoming has had a relatively low COVID rate compared to the rest of the country. Erin Morgan is executive director of the Casper Area Chamber of Commerce.
The joke out here is, you know, we've been practicing social distancing since we became a state. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, we're pretty spread out.
Still, Casper is the state's second largest city, with an active business district and a steady stream of tourists passing through on their way to places like Yellowstone. It's why a lot of Morgan's job used to be planning big events, like a recent chamber fundraiser.
That was a crab feed. Being landlocked in Wyoming, it's pretty interesting to coordinate all that. But we had about 450 people that came, and the crab was actually flown in the day before from Alaska.
Since COVID, she's gone from coordinating crab to coordinating PPE. The chamber has become a local distribution site for masks and hand sanitizer. With businesses already reeling, restaurant and shop owners want customers to feel as comfortable as possible. Just about everywhere, the work of being a chamber CEO has become as unpredictable as the pandemic itself. When the virus hit, Carl Benson, president of the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce, focused on helping Black-owned businesses get their share of PPP loans.
If you don't have a relationship with a bank, at that point, you're not in line at all. You're just not going to get in line.
But since the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police and the protests over racism and inequality, Benson's also become somewhat of a diversity advisor. He's been fielding calls from a lot of businesses, including Fortune 500 companies. Minnesota is home to 16, including Target and 3M.
I won't name names, I guess, but it's more, can you come in and talk to our employees about how we should be looking to hire, what this diversity, equity, and inclusion should look like? It's just been one after another. Like, I hang up and pick up another one.
Benson believes some of these conversations could pay off for his members down the line.
You're not only teaching our businesses and learn and educating our businesses and giving them resources and technical assistance, but it's really about, you know, everybody else as well.
Then there are the chambers themselves, which rely mainly on membership dues to stay afloat.
I have an office, I pay rent, I have a staff of 8, you know, we have expenses.
Quincy Hensel runs the Portland Regional Chamber of Commerce in Maine. The town's been slammed by the drop-off in tourism. Hensel's cut people's hours and started offering membership discounts.
Now is not the time for chambers to go away.
So, like everyone else, she's just trying to figure out how to keep the doors open. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Normal patterns of supply and demand, as I'm sure you know, because you're listening to this radio program by now, have been thrown for a loop in this pandemic. Food banks, for instance, have seen a huge increase in demand for their services. And for a lot of those food banks, their supply of volunteers who make up a good portion of their labor force has fallen, in part because a lot of those volunteers are over 55 and so are at greater risk in this pandemic. Consider that the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Joyce Idema, and I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I have lived here for 20 years. I retired when I was 80 years old because I said I didn't want to be the oldest person in the room, and I am now 86 years old. I started working for the Food Depot probably in May as a volunteer, because I read some things in the newspaper and I realized that with the onslaught of the pandemic, they were just desperately in need of more volunteers because the demand for food in Santa Fe was so enormous that they couldn't keep up with the preparation and the distribution of food. So I'm in perfect health. And so I thought, well, this is something good that I could do. We're well protected with masks and gloves, and we observe the distance, and we work for 3 hours, and it's pretty vigorous work. I sort of felt for a while that I was the potato queen, and I did nothing but take the large baking potatoes and put 8 in a net bag, and I did that a lot. You know, when the pandemic ends, which I, you know, keep your fingers crossed that it will end in at least in my lifetime. I think, you know, not everybody's going to go back to work. Not everybody's going to have the job that they had before. And we have one of the nation's, you know, the greatest poverty rate in small children, you know, and what the Food Depot has done in the last two or three months is more than double what they usually do. I realize how important volunteers were to the Food Depot and how much they were needed in it. I will just keep going. If they need me to come down and volunteer and pack onions, I'll come down and pack onions.
How about that? That was Joyce Idema in Santa Fe. To put some numbers on what she was saying about the Food Depot doing more than double the business it used to, in April, they distributed more than 1 million pounds of food to people in northern New Mexico, up from their 500,000 pounds a month in normal times. Take a minute, would you, and tell us about your personal economy. We'd love to hear it, and we'd love to get it on the air. You can do it online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which we kind of bury the lead, but I was thinking maybe putting it somewhere different in the program would make it stick in y'all's ears a little bit more. Today is Thursday, which here in coronavirus economic time means the weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment came out this morning. Happens in non-coronavirus times, too. It's just more important now. 1.4 million people applied for benefits in the past week, the 18th week in a row that number has been above a million. Also, and arguably worse, that is up from the number of people making claims last week, the first increase since back in the days of early April. The phrase you need to be thinking about here is permanent job losses. All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context. Also, as it happens, of the unemployment variety from the Department of Labor this morning, listed in a table headed persons claiming UI benefits in all programs. UI, of course, is unemployment insurance. 31.8 million Americans on some kind of government unemployment assistance. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.